Today's interview brought to you in part by Blue Microphone's Yeti Blackout, the ultimate professional USB microphone. Welcome to the show, Jeff, and thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me. Take a break from playing my guitar for a few minutes here.
Well, let's start in the basement and tell us, who are some of your early influences and what first intrigued you to become a musician?
When I was a little kid, my parents were in a group called the Folk Music Society of Sacramento, and my family's from the Bay Area here, but I grew up there because my dad worked as in the state senate. So my parents gave me a ukulele, I guess when I was 4 or 5 years old, and then the next year a guitar, and I learned to play it the same day I got it, and I didn't need the book, and I was writing songs at around 5 years old, so they were kind of supportive about that, so they ended up getting me another guitar, a little Stella, which I still have here, and then my next guitar was a Yamaha 12-string, and I don't know why my dad chose to get me that out of a pawn shop, but you know, real difficult to play, but I'm glad he did now because it really helped further my picking technique and my string skipping stuff that I do now on electric. But I didn't really switch to electric till I was in my late teens and I saw a band play at our high school and I really liked the guy was playing a Les Paul Jr. doing Ampeg and it just sounded so good to me. So I thought, well, maybe I'll start trying to master the idea of soloing on a guitar. And that's where that all came from.
Well, now, when you really got into it, how many hours a day were you practicing?
I was playing a lot, you know. Kindly enough, my mom would have me, you know, practice every day after school. There was a period there, maybe a month or two, that I actually took lessons. Other than that, I'm totally self-taught. When I was a little kid, she put me in with a guy named Gordon at Timothy B. Schmidt from the Eagles. His dad owned a music store, and she stuck me in there to get lessons of all things. And so I guess I learned how to play Georgie Girl. And I realized that wasn't my direction I wanted to go. No slight on the instructor. So I just went off and taught myself. So I was pretty dedicated. And then I started seeing players. And there was a girl that lived across the street from us named Cleo. And she was a little bit older, a couple years older than us. And that makes a difference when you're a kid. You know, she was like the cool chick on the block. And, you know, she had albums. And I didn't have albums. So she had albums, and she was playing stuff like Spooky Tooth. She was playing Johnny Winter, who I really fell into, thanks to her. So I'd go sit in her room and listen to her play these albums. So I really got turned on to some great players. And as far as influences go, I really latched on to Johnny Winter. And then when Montrose first came out, the first Montrose album, I just thought was fabulous. And I eventually ended up with the amplifier that was used on the first couple of Montrose albums, 310 Bandmaster, which I stupidly sold for rent in the 80s. But it's, I also listened to some Jeff Beck, the first couple of Jeff Beck records a bit, and Ritchie Blackmore. I really fell into Blackmore a lot. Machine Head album, of course, and then Burn and Stormbringer subsequently. Shuggy Otis, I might want to mention Shuggy Otis. When he was a kid, he had an album called Here Comes Shuggy Otis, and he was just 15 years old and just really, I mean, it was really pretty strong, just pentatonic 1-4-5 stuff, but he had real good technique. And back then, we just thought that was real groundbreaking. So we studied that a bit. But I got to say, I stopped listening to guitar players after a while. I decided that, I don't know if it was a conscious decision, but I said, I want to sound like myself. So I just started, we have a cabin up in the Lake Tahoe area where there's no electricity, no road, no phones. You have to take a boat to get there. And all there is to do is to read or play board games or fish or hike or water ski. And that's just how I grew up. So having a guitar up there, you sit around and play, and you come up with an idea, and you go, oh, that's interesting. Can I perfect that, or at least get it to proficiency to be able to use it? So that's how I self-taught for all those years, and that's what took me to being the type of player I am now, which is I've become kind of a backwards player, to be honest. My pick technique and I start with an upstroke. Everything I do is kind of not standard playing.
You kind of described it, but explain to us, you know, anybody could learn to play the guitar, but how do you put your fingerprint on it? So I know immediately that's Jeff Watson, that's B.B. King, that's Johnny Winter.
Vibrato, I think learning a vibrato early on was a big thing. Leslie West was another one. When Mountain came out, he had this really cool vibrato, you know, really strong vibrato. And I thought that was a nice thing to have in your toolbox. And I also like patterns that make my brain happy. I always write songs and guitar licks that just kind of tickle me. I go, oh, that's really unusual and weird. And I've got a lot of friends that are guitar players in the world, and I'll play things for them, and they'll go, why did you put those notes in there? It musically doesn't make sense. Steve Morrison, one of my best buddies, and I'll play things for him. He'll go, man, it's a good thing you didn't go to music college, because you would have never put those notes in that line. He goes, it's probably a good thing, because I don't know. That's what makes me happy. Those weird intervals and just strange voicings.
Is it around this time that you developed the eight-finger technique, or does that come later?
That came later. That I was real interested in picking, as I still am, you know. I really just love having accuracy, and I think it's important to be able to play what you think, you know. So I really focused on that for a long time, and I'm playing more accurately, and I'm a better player now than I ever was in the Ranger days. But I did study up on myself and really work hard to get that, my two hands working. But the eighth finger stuff came, ironically, right down the street from here. It was our band house where Jack and Kelly and Fitz and I and Sammy Hagar's drummer, and it was really a band house. A lot of people lived there already. And I wanted to get this lick to a song, and Fitz was playing on piano. I said, how could I find these notes? So I'm showing him the piano, and I dip around the piano. I'm not really a piano player, but I write on piano. That makes sense. I couldn't really perform on it. But so I thought, well, let's take that and apply it to the guitar. And it was just so useless at first. It just didn't correspond really well, especially with amplification. You get the other strings ringing and stuff. So I learned to self-mute. Now you can put a hair tie around the nut end of the neck and stuff and do some dampening. But I just stayed with it. And by the time we came around to the second record, this was after the first record, and I had that in my pocket, and we came up with a Rockin' America song, and I thought, you know, this might work in here, because it's an unusual kind of a major change solo section. So I thought, this might be a good fit. So we did it, and I got encouraged, because we were cutting the album in L.A., and Pat Thrall came by, who I had met previously with Pat Travers when I was much younger, and he came by and he said, hey, that's an important thing you're doing, Jeff, stick with that. And he goes, you got to utilize that. And the producer listened to him. And he said, okay, because I was really having a bit of trouble with it. So I stuck with it. I went back to the hotel and knocked the heck out of it. Came back in and cut that solo. And I also want to add that, you know, I get tagged with having come up with that technique. And I think that's very flattering. And I'm honored at that. But I think it's a misnomer. I guarantee you there was 1,000 other guys the room coming up with the same idea. It was going to happen no matter who it was. And I think what gave that tag to me was just the fact that I was in an MTV video doing it every hour on television. I don't really think I was the only guy thinking of doing that. And I know there's a lot of some of them are friends of mine that play it brilliantly. They've taken it to such a higher level. I'm very remedial in it. I use it more as an application, as a set, or now I use it very sparingly. But guys like Joel Hoekstra, he really hasn't done. One of my good buddies who actually took my spot at Ranger when I left. And Bumblefoot, Ron Thal, has got some crazy stuff going with that. So it's been taken even so much further than my early 80s stuff.
Let's back up from Ranger for a second. Tell me a little bit about the Jeff Watson Band. And I understand Eric Martin was your original singer?
Yeah. Eric was our first singer back in, I think, 76. And he was a local singer in the area. And I would see him. He was playing in the clubs around there with the cover band. I think it was called J.C. Michaels. And he was just so good. He was doing the Humble Pie stuff. He was just singing the heck out of the 70s music. He was so good, and he looks so young. He still looks young to this day. He lives right up the road here. And he's just got this great throat, great voice. And he was a quirky, funny guy. And he went to high school, a different school from me down the road. Yeah, he was in the band for a period there, but I was only doing original music, and it was really hard to get bookings. And I think that wasn't really fitting well. It was hard to keep people in place because it was hard to get gigs. We weren't being able to play in the clubs that much. Number one, we were underage. Number two, I only played music that I wrote. And that, to this day, I've never been in a cover band. I really think I've missed out on a lot from because of that. I only play what I composed. So it was an interesting time. And then we got a singer that used to be in the band Up With People named Jim Figger. And that's when I started getting good producers. Through Sammy Hagar, I met Fitz, and he started producing me. And then Fitz got busy with Sammy, and then Ronnie Montrose came in and started producing me. And that was the evolution of the Watson Band in the late 70s.
Continuing on with that theme, people say there's no music scene today. Well, describe for us what the Sacramento and Bay Area music scene of the late 70s and early 80s was like.
Well, obviously, not to say obviously, but it was a lot of the same people that are here still. You had the Grateful Dead, and you had Jefferson Starship, Airplane, and the Starship, and Huey Lewis was coming out. Montrose and Journey was coming out from the Bay Area. And Sacramento didn't have a lot of named talent coming out of that town. Some of the guys that used to come into my music store, I was a manager of a music store called Sunrise Music for a few years, which was wonderful. For my career, I owe a lot to the owner, Jack Catman, to let me base my band pursuit out of his music store. But a lot of guys coming in to take guitar lessons from our teachers. I didn't teach, but were the guys from Tesla. Tommy and Frank came into the store. So they came out of Sacramento. That's the other rock band that I can think of that's come out of there. There may be others that I'm not familiar with, but that was the only Sacramento scene. And I came out and came back down to the Bay Area to start Night Ranger, then became Night Ranger. But the Bay Area has always been pretty lively, and now, just in our little town here, there's a lot of players still living around here. Huey and the Dead and Journey and Santana, Metallica. There's a ton of Satriani lives down the street. I mean, it's really a musical area, but it doesn't have that same flavor. The club scene isn't what it used to be. And as we get older, I mean, everybody gets families and they go off and, the new generations take over the clubs and things. So maybe it's popping, but not to my specific knowledge.
In that time period, would we see the Jeff Watson Band, with Robert Barry and Greg Kinn, on a Tuesday for $7?
Yeah, I was playing some places called Slick Willie's now and then. Like I said, all original material. We had an hour and 15 show or so. It was just a concert set. So it was very limiting. I wasn't very wise. And I also had songs on the radio. I was on hot rotation on two of the stations up in Sacramento because that was free format days before corporate, huge ownership of all the media. We were on all the time. And unfortunately, I wasn't that wise because I didn't have product in the store to sell. So I was on the radio, so I was getting gigs, but I wasn't selling albums. It was kind of silly. And then because of Sammy and Ronnie, I was getting onto gigs. Like I was doing like 13,000 seater show with Hart and Sammy Hagar. I put Sammy on the show because the promoters asked me. So I said, yeah, sure, as long as Sammy puts me on the show. So that kind of thing happened. And then Ted Nugent put me on opening for him at our hometown place called Memorial Auditorium, which was a big boost. And out of that, I was actually getting signed to my own record deal when Fitz asked me if I wanted to jump and start a band with him. He had some guys down here that had a kind of a pop band that were used to be kind of a funk band. And he said, you want to jump in with these guys? We'll start something. We need to rock it up a bit, so you'd be the perfect guy, blah, 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 and bring in some guitar chops. And so that's what happened. That's why I left SAC. And that's the end of that.
I was thinking that Jeff Watson Band was, you know, relatively unknown, but you were already successful as that. I didn't know that.
Well, it's the big fish in a small pond. I would come down and play Keystone Berkeley, you know, the hometown, high visibility, but not nationally or internationally at all. But I was playing out away from there. I was hubbed out of SAC at the time, but I was playing Bay Area gigs, opening for shows, you know, playing it for Bill Graham events here and there. But it was nothing like what was to come with Ranger by any means.
Let's get into Night Ranger a little bit, and you kind of hit on it, but tell us, how did you guys go about getting the first record contract?
By getting turned down by everybody. Persistence. We cut a bunch of songs. We did worked in a couple of studios. My brother-in-law, before he was my brother-in-law, had a studio in Menlo Park. We went in there and did some demos. And Gary Peel, the Sammy Hagar's guitar player, lived in Petaluma. And when he went out with Sammy, he let us move into his house. Fitz and I moved in there. And I think Jack stayed at his mom's house. Whatever. We all gathered there and we did our first demos. I forget what songs we did. That was very big. I think we did Play Rough, maybe Penny, and No Sister Christian's Dead. I wrote Let 'Em Run. That was the first song that we wrote. I wrote that and Goodbye before we started Ranger. So I just brought those licks in. We didn't put Goodbye until the third album. But anyway, we got to Gary's house. It was an 8-track studio. We started sending things around. We sent them to a guy that the other guys in the band had worked with, named Pat Glasser, who had worked with Rubicon before, which was, like I said, a funk band that Brad, Kelly, and Jack were in. And he liked what he was hearing. So he got involved as a production company producer. Then he reshopped it. And that's how we ended up on Boardwalk Records, then later to become Camel, later to be swallowed up by MCA. That's the path of the record deals at that time.
How do you go from playing on the weekends to deciding I'm going to pursue this full time? You know, I'm done scrubbing dishes or whatever you were doing on the side.
Yeah, I did a lot of jobs. That's interesting. Well, that's what I wanted to do. Once I started my own band, and I saw that it was fun. It was a lot of work. And having the band be your namesake, which was a mistake. It wasn't supposed to be called Jeff Watson. It was supposed to be called Crossfire or something. And they made posters for a gig, and they just called it my name. And I wasn't pleased about that. But because they'd done that, it stuck. And so if your name's on it, you get hammered. If things go well, you know, everybody shares the credit. And if things go bad, it's your name, baby. So that's one thing that wasn't the best decision on their part to put my name on it. But it was something we wanted to do every night of the week. And it was, like you said, it was weekend gigs starting out. But working with Sammy and Fitz and Ronnie, I was really seeing how it could be a career. And, you know, Pat Travers had become a friend. I was involved with some bigger players that were doing it for a living and doing well at it. So I was very encouraged. And I just moved. Fitz goes, let's go. So I came back down to Mill Valley, where Fitz was living with Jack and his wife. And we all gathered there and we started working on it. I just moved in there. And that became our full-time thing. And we were really a broke band, struggling to do anything we could to pay the rent and, you know, to eat. I got to be very good at making good tasting food out of very cheap ingredients. It was a good time. You pull together like that. It's a band of brothers at that point. So, and then we were just taking gigs anywhere we could. We actually played as the Jeff Watson Band. Ranger had, we called us that, Philip and Sacramento gigs. And then we play as Ranger before we picked Night Ranger, which we had to do because we came out with the album called Ranger. and we were told we couldn't use the name. We already, somebody has, I think it's Kevin Russell actually has one of the first album covers, The Dawn Patrol, that says Ranger on it. There was a band in Kentucky somewhere that was called Ranger. They've been around like since the Civil War, so they had a name. So we had the song Night Ranger, and we said, well, we better just change this quick. Did.
Who did you go out on your first major tour with?
Our first, well, we were doing shows around here. Bill Graham was helping us out, kind of quasi-managing us. And he was such a great guy, and he would always give us great, he would take me aside, give lots of little niblets of advice the whole time he was alive. He would put us on with Judas Priest. He put us on with Motorhead at the old Waldorf. Some really unusual billings, because we were really a pop band. I was trying to drag it harder rock. But the band itself in the beginning was very, not punk, but pop, kind of. And so getting put in front of Judas Priest, and we played a Guitar Wars show up in Petaluma, and we were doing those type of local things anywhere we could get on. And then the first set of shows that we got on, I don't think it was Sammy. I think we did 2 weeks with her. No, Sammy put us on a few shows, too, to be honest. And I don't know the timeline. I don't remember it very specifically right this moment, but we went out with Heart for a couple of weeks, and they treated us so wonderfully. Anna, Nancy, and their band were just great to us, took us under their wing. And after that 2 weeks, we went from there, and we were starting to get some radio play with Don't Tell Me You Love Me. We went from that to the Kiss tour. So it was really a change of scenery to go onto the stage and have tanks on stage and nozzles hanging from the lighting dripping with fog and you know, it was insane. Kiss was in full makeup, and they took care of us really well. They became lifelong friends. That was a real eye-opener for us. And, you know, we encountered all the Knights of Satan service that went along with Kiss in the early 80s, and we got to wear their boots on stage now and then and just mess around. That was a really informative time for all of us. It was a real quick grow-up period for us.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about performing. How do you stay Jeff Watson the person and then walk on stage and become Jeff Watson the rock star and then go backstage and be Jeff Watson again? How do you deal with that psychologically?
I don't know. I guess because I know that you have to give people what they're there to be entertained, and you got to entertain them. And I'm not as, you know, frantic out there on stage as some, but you do have to put on a show, especially in big, you know, the rules you learn early on are the bigger the stage, the bigger the movements have to be, because the people in the back, they don't want to see people standing still. And so you have to develop that. And then when you come off, you just have to remember that, you know, everybody's the same. I have more, as much, if not more, respect for other lines of work, like doctors and teachers, scientists. I really hold them in such high regard that I really don't think of what we do as a business as being anything spectacular or deserving any accolades beyond in the performances. So I think that any ego that happens along with it is misapplied, and I don't like being in the room with ego. It doesn't go well in my life at all, and I won't have it around me. And that's, I think that if that helps answer your question, all the people I met as well, but the first people that were really kind to us coming up, like I said, Sammy being the first, and then Fitz and Ronnie and Travers, and then seeing Bill Graham, who worked with everybody, very kind guy, and all these players that we worked with, they were all so sweet. And then they went out and did these monstrous shows. It was funny. We used to go out. I would go have drinks with Paul Stanley after some of the shows, and he would take his makeup off. Nobody knew who he was. He was very, very humble, very sweet guy. And same with Gene. He's a real sweetheart. He's a great actor, too. I mean, he puts it on for the crowd. He puts it on for his interviews. But he was always just such a sweetheart in just one-on-one. So that was informative to me as well.
Let's continue on with that. Do you ever get butterflies to walk out there?
You know, I don't. And the times I get nervous, this is interesting. I learned a long time ago that I don't look at the crowd as being a crowd. I look at it as a bunch of individual people that all are glad that they're not up on stage doing what you're doing. So when you look at them, look at them as individuals. It's not groupthink. It's individual people thinking individually. So if you remember that, and just remember that they're glad that they're not on stage. You get the occasional guitar guy out there with the arms crossed. You know, once we start getting that guitar hero, you know, moniker, guitar hero, then you get the guys out there going, looking like, I could do that. And you got to, it's hard, but you got to ignore them and play for the majority of the people that are there to have a really fun time. So those are the things that I really, the times I get most nervous, and this is interesting. One of my best buddies is Steve Morse, who's in Deep Purple for 22 years now, but he had Dixie Dregs. And I didn't listen to Steve growing up. I'm sorry, Steve, but I didn't. But he and I became friends touring together. And so he stays here at the house. We go flying together, all kinds of stuff. And he'll always ask me to come up on stage and play, either with Purple or with his band or Dixie Dregs. And I make the mistake of watching the show before I go up. Now that one puts butterflies in my stomach. I get nervous. I'm thinking, what the hell do you need here for, Steve? You know, all I'm bringing is like rock boots. You know, this is insane. And he goes, hey, man, you're my best friend. Come on, we'll just have some fun. And that's the most intimidating. Playing with guys like him in front of people, I think, is where you really show off your works because, you know, they're the best players in the world, guys like Steve. So that's the only time I really have a case of nerves.
Let's move into Mother's Army and tell us, how did you first cross paths with Bob Daisley and how did Mother's Army come about?
Carmine Appice got a hold of me near the end of Ranger, when I was doing my Lone Ranger record, and I might mess up the timeline here, but we decided we want to try a project, and we were talking about different people, whether it be a singing bass player, and I always want to work with great vocalists. I'm really, you know, I love Sammy's voice. I ended up working with Steve Walsh and Jolene Turner. I love. I was always a vocal-oriented guy. Paul Rogers is one of my heroes, so. I was really insistent that we get somebody, legacy people that came in. And in the meantime, we were talking that Bob Daisley became available. And Bob flew in from England, where he was living then. And Bob and I just hit it off like crazy. I mean, our writing styles were really fun. He saw me as kind of another Randy Rhoads type guy because we just had these crazy ideas and we would develop them together. We'd sit here in the TV room out in the front deck in the forest with our guitars, and we would just write some really silly shit. And that's how that really developed. And then we tried, had a couple singers. I've got all these tapes, as a matter of fact, of different singers. Some real good singers, too. Kelly Hansen came in, who's a performer. Derek St. Holmes was in here. We had, you know what, I won't remember them all. But when Jolene became available, that was perfect, because I'd worked with Jolene on the road. He had opened up for us, and I'd heard him in the Rainbow stuff. So that just fell into place, and we had Bob and I by this time had all these songs going, and so that just locked, and it was so much fun. The guys would move in here, and we'd have 6 weeks of just hilarity. Bob would come in first, and we'd hone the songs out. Then Joe would fly in, and we'd work up the lyrics and rearrange things, and then Carmine would come in, we'd start cutting basics, and we just did this over and over, and it became very comfortable, familiar, the way we went at it. And I think it shows in the albums. I'm still really proud of those records.
Do you have a favorite of the three?
Well, like anything, I think your favorite is always the last thing you wrote, you know? So I guess the Fire on the Moon record is really nice to me. I like that record. I think the first record, we were trying to find ourselves with Mother's Army. And the second record, we were a bit disillusioned with what was going on in the world politically a bit. I think we went a little bit far towards the, not political, but the kind of message-oriented, which we kept in all the songs. We're very message-oriented songwriters. But the third album, we just decided to go for it. And by that time, we brought Ainsley in to play drums. And it was a different approach. When Ainsley would move in here, we went at it without a click track. We were cutting on tape. We still have I have a 2-inch machine in the studio here with 16 track heads on it, 24 track machine, but it sounds better with 16 heads. So we used that. We'd use two machines to mix on. We cut on two reels. But anyway, we decided not to use a click track because Ainsley, as well as Carmine, I'm sure, but Ainsley's just a metronome. He's a walking metronome. Ainsley chops and land back on the one. And it was just fascinating to Bob and I, and Ainsley would stand in the same room. We'd just go direct through the control room, and we just mic up Antique Drums, and we just went for it. So the album has a lot more spontaneity, and the songs breathe a bit more, because on the first two, of course, we used click tracks just for assembly purposes. But the third album was just played real time.
Now, whether it's Mother's Army or Night Ranger or a solo project, once it's recorded and packaged and ready for the consumer, do you ever listen to that again?
I have a really bad habit of never listening to anything I've done or watching anything I've ever done. People give me grief about this, but I've never Googled myself or I've never watched any videos people have put up of me online. They go, "Will you share this?" And I'll share it. But they'll say, "What did you think?" And I say, "I don't watch." Because I'm afraid, in my mind, the magic that happened at any event that you're participating in is of that moment in that room with those people. And I'm not sure that's going to translate to me watching it on my computer, my iPad or phone or whatever it may be now. And I think I will have the tendency to critique it and find fault with what I played. And that can be instructive as far as developing better techniques and things. But I think it does more damage because I'll be less hesitant to try new things if I see these things fail. And, you know, nobody's great every time they play. So I have a tendency not to listen and go back. I did listen to some Mother's Army recently because we were going to use it for a movie. So I pulled up a couple songs, and I think it holds up really well. And I was talking with Bob Daisley just a couple days ago. We were talking about, he had gone through and listened to it, and Joe Lynn Turner wrote in too, of all things. And we were just talking amongst ourselves that it really has held up for all of us. So, yeah, I mean, every now and then you'll hear a snippet of things in it. It translates.
I know your fans would love a new album from you, but with the industry basically non-existent, is there really any benefit to you or any other artist to release a full album?
Man, there's a lot of chatter about that right now, isn't there, David? I mean, I'm seeing people commenting about what Roger Daltrey and the Who guys are saying about the industry, and you know, Alan Parsons saying the MP3 should be banned. I mean, all this chatter about the industry and digital music. And I think that at the end of the day, I'm an artist, and I have to write and record. I write every day. I have so many songs that I have not released yet, that I've not, some of them not finished recording yet, and I have some in the can. And so I do have to put out some new material, because if it doesn't come out, it's not really a song if you don't release it. And you never really finish an album or a song. You actually abandon it. And that's the benefit, in my mind, of having a producer. I'm really a big advocate for, even though I am a producer and an engineer, I don't like to do that for myself or for Mother's Army stuff. I did engineer and produce some of it, but I like to have other people. And the main reason is because, besides the talent, Joey P is a great producer who's worked with me. Having the guys in the room that can say, "That was the one. That was the take. That was the solo. Don't try to perfect it. The magic was in those kind of off notes. That's where the humanity lies in that performance." Those kind of observations are what give albums their magic. And if you go back and listen to, I don't know, old Bad Company stuff with Mick Ralphs playing, or even some of the Foreigner, original Foreigner songs, where Mick Jones plays these really funny notes that just are just crazy. I listen for them now. Wait for them. And that's, I don't know, something that gives it humanity, having kind of flaws now and then. So that's my take on it. As to my new music, I write it constantly. And I just was arranging, before I spoke with you today, arranging a rehearsal in here to start capturing some drums on some of my new material. I got people coming in the next couple of weeks. And I'm also in the middle of producing an album for somebody else. And I'm also in the middle right now of a second rewrite of a screenplay for a movie for Hollywood. So, you know, it's juggling hours is what it is.
You mentioned Hollywood, and that goes into our next question. You can be seen in Disney's Enchanted. And tell us about filming the scene for That's How You Know.
That was a lot of work for that 4 minutes. That was 3 weeks in July in Central Park. I think it was that we had a couple rain days. I think it was 17 or 18 days of filming to get that 4 minutes. And it's a funny scene. I'm like, "Where's Waldo? I'm, where's Jeffro?" On top of tractors and up on the castle. And, you know, it was really fun. I mean, Amy Adams is great. Patrick's great. And the director, Kevin Lima, is one of my best friends, and he lives right next door to me. obviously that's how I got in the film, because I'm not, there's no acting involved in that one. But I, but last doing it, my wife Yolanda's in the movie. She's waving, holding their daughter at the end of that scene, waving in the park. But anyway, that was just, we did some of the voiceover work here. That was another thing that came out of that. And I also wrote a couple, or they pitched me to change a couple songs for a couple scenes. And we tried a few things that didn't work. We did some of the voices here. Some of the singing for some of the other characters in the film were done here at my studio. So it was a really fun time, and it's kind of a kick. And a lot of people were kind of curious about what that was. I wasn't the naked guy in New York, that's for sure. You know, there's some guy, I guess, that walks around in his underwear and plays guitar, and he's in a lot better shape than I am. I'm not him, that's for sure.
Sort of just touched on it again, but you've scored music for both film and TV, and when you do projects like that, do the companies steer your direction, or is that up to you?
If we're writing to scene, then we'll get the scene, and we'll write to the action itself, to live action. And we did some of that for Nash Bridges. Don Johnson had a show called Nash Bridges, which was filmed here in San Francisco, and I was writing for some of that. And also, he was using some of my solo material. Like, I think he used a couple of Lone Ranger pieces and maybe even another Army piece. And those, they choose. Their music director chooses those. And in the other case, the music director would give us scenes and say, what can you come up with for this? And so that was how that worked. Plus, Lon Johnson was coming over here, and I was producing his new music stuff. He sings and writes, so he would come in here at night and work out of the studio here, too. So that was kind of a wild time, as it were.
As somebody with no talent, explain to me a little bit about your songwriting style. You know, do you hear lyrics in your head, music in your head? You know, how does it come from your brain to what I listen to?
You know, it's interesting. They call it the muse. And the muse is really, when it hits you, I think it's best to capture it right away. Like have a little tape recorder next to your bed or a pad of paper, which I always do. And it's oftentimes a line that is said by somebody, being if you're out for dinner somewhere or just somebody over at the house, and they say this funny line and you just go, wow, that's a really good point. I could use that. And then you extrapolate it out and it becomes a verse or a chorus and you go, okay, I better finish this or it's going to fall into this huge pile I have of sayings and lyrics that haven't gotten used. So I dedicate myself and I sit down and I focus on it. And the other times it'll be when I'm practicing my guitar, just loosely, maybe watching TV or just sitting on talking or sitting outside, and I'll just stumble across a lyric that just sounds unusual. I go, wow, would that work if I played it with this? And that becomes the foundation for a song. And then the work starts. I mean, the real work, it's easy to start a song. It's really difficult. The difficulty is in finishing. I mean, that's every songwriter will probably tell you that. That finishing the song is the clinch. And so that's where it comes from. It's just the weirdest little things. Or I'll see something outside. You know, I watch, we live up in the forest, so we have all these wild animals here. I'll see interplay. I'll just watch how things interact with each other. And that gives me ideas of a perspective. You know, songs, the way I write it, I like to think of perspectives. I often write from the perspective of single people or a married woman or a child or an animal, but I'll put it in human terms. And most people don't know that when they listen to the songs, but that's where it starts. So it can be anything. And if the muse hits you, David, you just got to go, oh, let me grab this. And you got to stay on it. And then you come back to it. And this is the interesting thing is I'll come back sometimes. Like I was in the studio yesterday knocking out this song I thought was the greatest thing ever a couple days ago. Went up there yesterday, knocked it out. This morning, I went, oh, that's not even near done. It needs to move. Everything you're working on is the best thing in the world at that moment. And then, you know, you put on the shelf for a day or two, you come back to it, you go, oh, wait a sec. Yeah, this needs work. So anyway, that's my progression of it, but I don't think that everybody has the same approach. I mean, it's very open to how people come up with stuff. I know, like, the Eagles guys would start with lyrics or poems. And I was also a poetry writer for a long time. I've published poetry and books and things. So it'll oftentimes be a poem I've written about an event, and I'll just decide to put music to the poem. And that occurs maybe 30% of the time. But most of the time it's fresh at the moment.
Is there any different, you know, is the approach the same whether you're writing, you know, a 40-second intro to a TV show versus a 3-minute pop song?
You know, for me anyway, I write so many little things that I just record and stow away for future use. And so if I'm asked to do something for a scene, I'll review parts that I've had. So I'm writing constantly. So I'm every day, I'm putting little bits down. So I have hundreds of these little things. And I'll think, oh, that might fit here, or that sound, or that emotion needs to be in this place. And I'll try listening to something I've done and go, that's close. What it really needs, it needs to be that feel, but in a minor, you know, more minor, more strings, you know, take out the banjo kind of thing. You know, you gotta make it fit. And that's kind of how I approach it. And then if that doesn't work, I'll just grab a guitar, or I'll sit down at the piano. We have a couple grand pianos here. I'll just pick one and sit down. And that's where I do, like I said, a lot of writing is on piano. I find it very emotional. And it's kind of inspirational because I'm not a good piano player. So, again, I play a lot of wrong notes that make my brain happy. And then I'll go, oh, that may be wrong, but I kind of dig it. So let me make this song that nobody's ever going to hear anyway. That's kind of how that starts.
When you were recording on tape versus, you know, recording digitally, do you think the fact that you can spend more time messing around with it, is that a pro or a con?
The pro about tape is obviously how good it sounds. And the other pro about tape is it's a very expensive format, and you have to take it really seriously when you're going to start sticking on 2-inch tape. You know, you better start to, you have to be ready. I mean, this isn't a demo studio that we own. It's a full facility. So I don't normally go in there and do demos anyway, except now and then for myself. But the one thing, this is a funny thing about tape. There's quite a few, but one is that when, like, let's say you're going after a drum take, and the guy doesn't get it. It's the time waiting for the tape to rewind. The drummer has enough time to imagine himself screwing it up even worse than that. And digitally, you go, let's go again, boom, and you're going again. So there's pluses and minuses. You save quite a bit of time waiting for rewind, and fast forward. As well as pluses of digital are so many and very obvious, the editing capabilities. Sadly, the editing becomes so tempting to start cutting everything together instead of playing every part top to bottom. And so I really try, and I'm not suggesting everybody does, but everybody has their own techniques, but I try to make sure I play real performances top to bottom. Even if I have to punch in some spots, I don't want to take and cut 2 bars, make it the same, duplicate top to bottom, because then it has sterility to it. And I think people can tell that, to be honest. So that's my take on it.
How'd you get involved with the Randy Rhoads Remembered concerts?
I tell you how. Joel Hoekstra. I've got this group of guys I talk to every day. All my guitar buddies. We've got a private group of guitar guys that I started a couple of years ago. And we talk every day. And it's Joel Hoekstra, Bumblefoot, Steve Lukather, Doug Rappaport, Dane Jenkins from Pablo Cruz, Steph Burns from Vasco Rossi and Huey, and Tom Morris from Huey and Creedence, and Bob Daisley as well. And we talk every day and about all subjects of the world. And Joel said, Jeff, I'm going to be out in L.A. I'm, you know, doing my thing, but I've got time. I'm going to go out there. You should come down. It would be great for you and I to do this Randy thing together. It would blow people's minds because the two guys that play all the same parts in Ranger. And Joel always gives me grief because he says I made his life difficult. that he had to play, and yeah, I don't know if you've ever heard Joel play, but he's a monster out of that. We get a good laugh at that, and so we went to LA, and he brought me into it, and through that, it went really well, and really malleable. So you know, somebody asked me to do something, sure, if it's benefits, and I played a lot of benefit things, so I said, let's do this, and so that turned into doing more shows, and then another year of it, another NAMM, and then we went and did the Axis and Anchors cruise, which was really fun. And through that, I've met some really great folks, too, like Phil X and Mike Rolando and Rudy Sarzo, I've known forever. We used to live in the same apartment complex. Brian Tichy, who was really wonderful about continuing to ask me to come in because he's kind of at the head of a lot of the Randy Rhoads stuff. Great drummer, man. Guy's a blister and a great guitar player. Brian Tichy is an overall real talented cat. So those guys, and they keep me in the loop. So if I'm available and if there's a slot, then I'm in there. And that's how that came to pass.
You've traveled the world many times. Can you share a Spinal Tap moment with us?
I'll give you two Spinal Tap moments. One is the fact that I played with Spinal Tap. Two nights with them as a special guest here in San Francisco. And I know one of the songs I played was Break Like the Wind. I worked with Chris and Michael before the show to learn the parts, and I learned the stage moves with them. And it was before digital cameras, and I don't think there's any footage of it, but I do have a poster and a photo of me with the band, which is pretty cool. And they're real nice guys, and that was really fun. But a spinal moment would be, one good one would be Tyler, Texas. We were playing, and Joe Lanterna was opening the shows. It was a very long time ago. And we wanted Panther to come out. I think it might have been Kelly's birthday or something like that. Yeah, it might have been Kelly's birthday. And one of the guys in Joe Lynn Turner's band or one of their crew had a girlfriend that also did pole dancing stuff, maybe more than that. And so we were going to, during Sister Christian, she was going to come out and dance across the stage, go up on our ramps and our risers and come down and go to Kelly's drum kit and kind of dance and be sexy. Well, she got over to Kelly, she got all sexy, then she went up to the top of the risers in front of a sold-out show and took a flashlight and started doing things with a flashlight. it was a real showstopper because the lights were on, the parents were in the back of the hall because it was our encore song. So we had all these parents in the back waiting for their kids. Got this lady on stage using a flashlight as a dildo, and we were banned from Tyler, Texas.
It's awesome. That is awesome.
And it wasn't that awesome. It wasn't a proud moment for me.
Oh, that's great. In closing, Jeff, is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, if you're guitar players, I recommend you keep writing and composing and working and turning off other guitar players for a while and just sit with your own guitar and try not to be influenced. If you want to have your own voice and signature style and personality, I really think I've been getting a lot of stuff coming my way from all these great guys out there that can play a zillion notes. They have such facility and it's very impressive, but it can become very cookie cutter. So my recommendation is really work on songwriting and write things that somebody isn't playing already and develop those things. And I know that's a tall order, but I think it really helps in giving you a voice. And I also think being kind, and the other thing I would say to people in music is share the spotlight. The broader the beam of the spotlight, the better you look as a human being. Narrow spotlights connotate ego, and you don't want to ever have that. You want to step back, let other people shine. Encourage everybody around you to do well, lift people up. And I really think that's the way to make it in this business, or any business for that matter. And that's my suggestion.